boys and girls. Today, we're going to talk about Star Trek. Now, I keep thinking about, you know, different subjects to talk about. And I thought, you know, I'm a huge fan of Star Trek. You know, I've never been to a Star Trek convention or anything like that, but I would go if I knew where one was. I just never pursue it, you know. But now, why do an episode about Star Trek, right? The major reason is the universe that Gene Roddenberry created, I think, is a universe that we're all striving for. And if you ever want to put something in your mind that's going to perhaps condition your thinking, right? Because everything, you know, you are what you eat and you are what you see and digest, right? I think Star Trek is a great thing to put in your head. Now, there's a lot of pop science that's injected in the episodes. We'll get to that. But overall, I think that Gene Roddenberry is one of the most under-celebrated geniuses of our time. Social genius. And I'm going to get into the reasons why I think that. Now, some of you will be full-on Trekkies, and you have seen every single episode, every single show on TV. Supposedly, they just greenlit a new TV show, which will be out in 2017. So, can't wait to see that. But some of you will have, for very understandable reasons, have never seen a Star Trek episode on television. For whatever reason, you put it on, and it just rubbed you the wrong way. And I totally understand that as well. So, I'm going to take you through sort of the history of Star Trek. I'm not by any means a Trekkie, so I don't have every single, you know, piece of trivia, but I'm going to try to hit it for at least 60 minutes the things that are important to me about this show and sort of the latent realization of the brilliance of what Star Trek was all about, because I'll just get into it. You know, when I grew up in the 70s, my dad always had Star Trek on, all the reruns, and it was just didn't turn me on. You know, it was, for some reason, you know, I could feel the cheaper sets that they were forced to film on. And, you know, now I think it's endearing. Now I love to see it. But when I was a kid, you know, I was watching Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Star Wars, you know, everything was very polished and amazing. And so to watch, you know, some sort of skit on a set where you could see the background of the studio walls and the fake foliage and stuff like that, it just didn't turn me on. And I wasn't getting intellectually involved. So I was probably about seven years old when I was really aware that Star Trek was playing on the television. All right. Then the Star Trek films start coming out. I'm going to go through each one of them, not all the films, but I'll go through each one that really meant something to me personally, and then I'll get into the TV series that started in 87 up to about 2004 or 5, I guess. I guess it's 5, yeah. Now, you will have heard me mention a couple times the 1956 movie Forbidden Planet. Forbidden Planet is the pinnacle of what we call the atomic era science fiction filmmaking. There's essentially two massive films out of the 50s. I was always told The Day the Earth Stood Still came out in 49, but then someone, I think, said it's 51. I should look that up. But you have The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is about an alien that lands in Washington, D.C. in a like a little baseball field, and you have a alien that comes out that's very human, very dapper looking gentleman, but he's dressed in this outfit at first, which makes him look like an alien, like he's made of metal or something. He comes out and he's trying to offer man something, and he reaches out with his hand. He's got this weird little wand thing in his hand, and some dopey soldier shoots his hand and destroys it. And of course, that had all the gifts to mankind that we keep talking about, like the alien promise side of things. But then Gort, his big giant 9-foot metal robot, comes out and starts zapping all of the weapons, kills all the guns, melts them all away, melts the tanks away. I'm assuming, I can't remember how the shot went, but he didn't kill anybody, so it must have been the occupants of the tank were either, I think they jumped off the tank, that's what it was, because they want to make sure no one felt like anyone got killed. But the day the Earth is still is sort of about the alien promise and how we're, you know, extremely terrified of anything that's different than us, you know, and how the military-industrial complex at that era was seen to potentially react to an alien visiting. Because he looks human, he just simply was captured, then he escaped, and he's held up in some boarding house while he tries to teach the world a lesson, and he stops the entire planet for a day, or an hour, or something, I can't remember. The day there, I guess it's a day, right? Yeah, of course. But the 1956 film, Forbidden Planet, is the genesis of what becomes Star Trek. And again, like I've said, Leslie Nielsen, who we saw in Naked Gun episodes doing incredibly funny comedy, you know, he was actually an extremely talented actor his whole life. And this particular movie does him absolute justice. But you can even tell, the nice thing about Forbidden Planet is that you have sort of America at its quintessential peak of culture, of education, of exploration. You know, in 56, we had colleges releasing papers about how to do anti-gravity, you know, just to give you an idea. And, you know, it all got wiped away. We'd figured out electromagnetism probably disturbs the ethereal winds and things can be weightless. It's very interesting. But in this era, the amount of science in this science fiction film is pretty phenomenal. But the reason why it's the genesis, and you've heard me say this a couple times if you've seen every single episode, it was this idea that when a spaceship lands from an American-made academy or whatever, you have a ship's captain, a ship's science officer, and a ship's doctor all going out to explore something. And the film is about, just to give you a little bit of a trailer, the film is about a crew from Earth that is on this total flying saucer-looking spaceship, and they are flying to a planet where a colony has disappeared. And as soon as they start orbiting, this guy Morpheus, I actually said it wrong, I said Morbius. There's Mobius, Morpheus, and Morbius, right? One's an artist, one's a guy in Matrix, and one's the this dude in Forbidden Planet. But Morpheus is a linguistic PhD professor, and as soon as they get in orbit around this planet and start calling down, this professor calls up and says, "How may I help you?" So it's part of the missing colony. And they said, "Well, we're here, we're your relief. We're here to pick you up." And he says, "Well, I'm fine. You don't need to land." And he goes, "Well, I'm sorry, but I have my orders. I have to check in on the colony." And he goes, "Commander, you know, if you land here, I can't take any responsibility for what might happen to you." Intriguing, right? And so Leslie Nielsen, of course, lands the ship. It's this beautiful landing sequence that is, it is just one of those moments where film never got any better, you know, for what they had at their disposal, the special effects, both from an animation standpoint to a lot of the in-camera props that they had built. It was just masterfully done. They invented the robot, Robbie Robot, for this particular movie. So if any of you have seen Robbie Robot in your time, not to be confused with the one in Lost in Space. That's a slightly different, I never liked the one in Lost in Space because he just seemed to be kind of a dork. But Robbie the Robot's cool, so, right? But Robbie the Robot is something that this guy Morpheus built. Actually, I think it's Morbius. Morbius is the dude, right? But anyway, the ship's captain, science officer, and the doctor are soon greeted by Robbie the Robot pulling this cart behind him. And they hop on board, and they go visit Morbius. And they find out that this guy is totally chill. He's totally relaxed. He's in a beautiful paddy bill. He's got this gorgeous daughter. And the only thing weird is that everyone else in the colony was murdered by some mysterious force as they decided to leave the planet. And so the captain's like, "Wow, I didn't expect this to be your status. So I have to report back to, you know, Central Command on Earth and get new orders." And so that puts them there on the planet for a little bit longer. And this guy's like, "Dude, you guys can't stay. Whatever killed my shipmates, my colonists, friends, is going to kill you, potentially. Now, the guy's wife had died of, I think, natural causes, maybe childbirth or something like that. But, you know, it goes without saying, Leslie Nielsen falls in love with this gorgeous daughter. And the rest of the film concludes beautifully. So you got to see this film. It needs to be something you've seen and something you can talk about with friends. Now, that's approximately 10 years prior to Star Trek getting made. Now, I personally don't know all of the details of Gene Roddenberry pitching Star Trek to, I believe, what ended up being Paramount. But I know that what he had done was written several things in his lifetime, and he had written this incredibly insightful new scientific world. He took the genesis, again, of Forbidden Planet, which is just sort of the configuration of expedition groups off of some flying vehicle, and he had put together what I think is very important for us truthers is a series. And again, if you go back and watch the original first two seasons of Star Trek, which I guess is 67 and 68, you have a guy that is exposing the class structure of the world, the elitism of the world, the ruling class, you know, the grasshoppers that rule the bugs from Bugs Life. By the way, I never put any real props for Bugs Life. I think Bugs Life is a film that it's cheesy looking today. But again, if your kid had to see a movie, Bugs Life is great because you teach your kids that there's just a few asshole grasshoppers that have fear over the people. And this theme's in a bunch of stuff, right? Three Amigos even has it, you know, with El Wapo and his dudes. And there's a bunch of movies like that, right? It's this little gangster group ruling a whole town by fear. But Gene exposed this formula over and over and over again in his episodes. And the studios, which have slowly been co-opted, right, by these sort of mind-programming executives, said, we want less thinking and more gunshots and gun battles and fighting. We want more action in your scripts. Now, what's interesting about that is if you heard that argument today, you'd be like, of course, kids are stupid. This is exactly what they want to see. But back in the 50s and 60s, you had a highly educated population that was absolutely getting the science fiction side of things. And the proof of that is that 10 years earlier, and these are my recommendations, if you're a Trekkie and you haven't heard of these other two franchises, you are in for a treat, okay? There's two 1950 radio series on, you can get them. I got mine at archive.org. You can get free MP3s for this stuff. Now iTunes, I believe, sells them for $1.99 to 99 cents a piece. They're still worth that money. But there was the first series was directly in the mid-50s called 2000 Plus. It was about a science fiction series. And so they took all these science fiction writers who are writing little short stories, which is the business 20 years before, where you get your Heinleins and your Asimovs and your Philip K. Dicks and, you know, all these dudes, right? Asimov. And they made this radio series out of it. Now, 2000 Plus, you'll hear this big Hammond organ. And you'll hear this, really kind of sliding the scales all over the thing to create kind of a spaceship sound. And so it's a little bit more antiquated, but the stories are fantastic once they start. Once a 2000 Plus finished, you had something called X-1. X-1 had finally had the spaceship sound effect. Just the theme music alone, when you hear it's a countdown of a rocket blasting off. Once you get acclimated to the value of an X-1 episode, which is essentially a science fiction radio Twilight Zone, before Twilight Zone came out in 59, right? They have twists, they have funny-ass episodes with mice being the main characters, but they have super serious. They have eerie, crazy ones with little kids talking to aliens. I mean, it is utterly brilliance on top of brilliance, right? We've been told that we're smart now and they were dumb back then. And of course, most of us truthers have realized that back in the 50s, we had reached the pinnacle of education. Our educational system was perfect. Reading, writing, and arithmetic was perfect, right? So you have this super educated group of people, and Gene Roddenberry was one of those people. So Gene pops out of that era, looks around. He's super intelligent, reads a lot of science fiction, obviously, right? And starts writing the Star Trek series. And people got it. Now, Star Trek in the 60s is, I think, largely different than the Star Trek that we know from 87 and up, especially in the films as well. But the films towed a lot of the stuff from the 60s, right? But the one thing you need to know about Star Trek in the 60s, and I didn't know this until recently, you Trekkies, you know all this stuff, but Gene Roddenberry quit after the second season. And I had felt this shift in the Force when watching the show again, because I went back in my 30s and bought all the remastered episodes and watched them over again. My jaw was on the ground. I couldn't believe how much of the themes of today, of literally, if you consider yourself a truther, which is someone who's trying to expose the cabal of folks that run the world poorly, Gene was on top of this in a massive way. And his there's something called a theme inside of a story, and it's just generally the overall arc where you can replace the characters all you want, but the same action takes place, right? His themes were massive, and the more he wrote these themes and the more he exposed the power structure of the world, the more the studios were pounding him to put in these dopey themes of essentially take gunslinger westerns from the 50s and just turn them into science fiction fight scenes. And you know, we do have some legendary scenes because of these fight scenes being turned on. So Gene did a great job. You know, it was Captain Kirk fighting a lizard out there in Apple Valley. You know, there's so many fights with William Shatner, James T. Kirk's character, right? That we do love those scenes. But they wanted to overwhelm the each script with just senselessness. And Gene fought it. So the third season of Star Trek in 69... got silly. You know, you'll see some episodes and your jaw's on the ground, you know. Now, the other thing that Gene brought us in the 60s, which is largely missed on kids these days, is desegregation. I think that, you know, every Trekkie knows what I'm saying, and you guys know 50 times as much as I'm saying, so I apologize for missing super-duper details, but you have Gene Roddenberry in real life is married to a woman that plays a nurse who ends up being just a phenomenal actress in the later series in the 90s. But he was also dating Uhura on the side in real life. So you have a white man dating a black woman during a time when people are marching in the streets and when civil rights was just a hot topic, man, you know. And so he portrayed her as an equal in the eyes of everyone watching, which I think was a big deal for that time. Today, it's like, why aren't there more black people in this show, right? But he cast everyone from different races constantly. He had a Ruski on the bridge, right? Well, here we are in the Cold War, and he puts a Russian guy up there, which I believe, I think maybe he was weapons. Gosh, I think Sulu was the pilot, right? But you have a Japanese guy, George Takei, or Takai. God, I can't remember how he wants to say his name. I guess Takai, right? But, you know, puts him in the front. You have the red shirts. Everybody who gets killed, those races rotate constantly. It was just a huge deal back in the day. Now, he didn't have really the Prime Directive and a bunch of other stuff that ends up happening in the 80s and 90s. But it still was a very educated storyline about, you know, humans going to a bunch of different planets. You know, Kirk sleeps with the green chick, right? Talk about racial equality, you know. Like a lot of fathers and sons suddenly were ready to sleep with green chicks as soon as they could find one. But he leaves, and the third season gets really crazy and weird. And, it, you know, what's interesting about it is it's almost an odyssey to watch the third season at this point. You know, they have a hippie episode, which is probably the worst episode, where everyone's singing and dancing and stuff like this. But it's stupid as it relates to the Star Trek franchise. But it's an interesting cross-section and example of where culture was at the time this was made. So they were bringing in the 60s movement into the Star Trek show. And it was sort of a time capsule of what might have been sort of the consciousness of that era. You know? the show concludes and they cancel it, right? And there's a little bit of a cabal about why Star Trek was canceled. Now, once you see the third season, you can see a number of reasons why someone would cancel it, because some of the shows were a little, you know, wonky. But I think overall, the viewership was really, really intense. But they started moving Star Trek later and later in the day, taking it outside of the gigantic demographic pockets that were watching the show. And that's really signs of a sabotage sort of, you know, act on, Paramount doesn't own a television channel, so I can't remember who actually published the actual television series on this thing. We know Paramount owns the franchise now, so I don't know if it's some subsidiary relationship, but they said that the ratings went really low, that people weren't watching it. Well, they sabotaged the ratings by moving it outside of this realm, because it constantly had this theme of reminding people during war, just like War Pigs, the song by Black Sabbath, that, you know, there's these people at the top that play with us like pawns, you know, and they never go to war. They just start them and walk off. And so this theme was very dangerous, and it was very hard to probably continue writing the series when you have the first two seasons, you know, establishing the minimum intelligence of our characters, and you can't write a sequel episode where everybody gets stupid, right? It loses their intelligence. But what's interesting is that when Star Trek was pulled off the air in 69, you have the biggest letter writing campaign in the history of television. Over 25,000 letters were shipped into the studios to say, get this thing back on the air. But they didn't do it. You know, today, you know, the equivalent numbers that we're talking about in today's, that would be millions of people on the internet, right, writing in. We got Family Guy back. We got a Firefly movie. I mean, all kinds of protests have brought things back, right? Someone brought Crystal Pepsi back. But they were trying to tell the world that no one cared about this show. Okay. So by 1972, in a big convention hall in New York, you have over 5,500 people show up to a convention. They just made it out of thin air. Now, that is an amazing following, to get people without an internet, okay, just snail mail letters and word of mouth, to bring 5,000 plus people into a warehouse to have a convention for a show that was on television. I'm unaware of any show in the history of America up to that point that ever had such a thing. But they did, because the show was so popular. So the whole ratings reason why Star Trek was canceled, I believe, is complete bunk. You know, and I'll give you a couple more examples of things being canceled, because at the very end of Star Trek with Enterprise, which again, a lot of you didn't watch, but it is, for me, the best one that's ever been made. In 2005, they canceled Enterprise. It's the last series to ever be on television. But if you look at the final season, the fourth season that they did a whole 9/11 inside job inside the first episode of, I believe, the fourth season, which is that the Vulcans organized a false flag hit on one of their embassies, got a bunch of people killed, got a bunch of Starfleet Academy people, one of the main guys from Starfleet gets killed, a bunch of Vulcans get killed, and they blame it on the Romulans just to kick off this war. It's the exact theme of 9/11. And ironically, Enterprise started the month of 9/11 in 2001, in September. So their ratings were down the tubes from the very beginning, because it was released in a bad time period in history. But as soon as they did this series, boom, the whole thing was canceled. And everybody was on totally confused, because the series was so amazing. Okay. Now, rewinding back to Star Trek, you then have, and this is not terribly important to our theme here, but I'm going to advance up to the 80s very quickly here, but you have the Star Trek film. And one of my buddies, Richard Taylor, worked on Star Trek film, and then Sid Mead also worked on it and designed the V'ger entity. But you have a situation where Gene was invited to the party, and he was very boisterous about everything. He had to have it his way all the time, and these guys were trying to convince him to upgrade the Enterprise a little bit further than it was. I think it turned out gorgeous, you know. I mean, I think the ship looks fantastic, but people trying to convince him to take in a little bit more science, because he had 10 years of evolution in the science of of technology, and they said, you know, can we move this here and there? Just a little bit. It'll still look just exactly the same, but it just will explain a little bit better. And he wouldn't have any of it, which is interesting. But the movie largely comes out and fails. You know, and this was 79. A couple years goes by, and they create The Wrath of Khan. And The Wrath of Khan was the very first film that really brought back the series, because it was dead. But I don't believe Gene was invited to the second one. And I could be wrong about that, but I just watched a special about that, and they said that because the first one tanked so hard, they were like, okay, get away, because your inertia for your own franchise is killing this thing. There's a scene where Spock dies in Wrath of Khan. And in terms of cinematic excellence, this might be just one of those things. If you're 1,000 years in the future and someone's asking what are some of the most epic moments on film, I think that William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy playing Captain Kirk and Spock on both sides of a piece of glass saying goodbye to each other, which is weird because they ended up, you know, they... At least Shatner had a problem with being in the same room with Nimoy after a while. Not sure what that stupid rivalry was all about, but it is one of the best scenes ever caught on film. I mean, you could be the roughest, toughest dude in the world, and man, you never shed a tear or feel choked up, but man, this will reach into your soul and say, oh, remember this feeling? You know, it's incredible. So Wrath of Khan is one you have to see. If you haven't seen all the other films, it's really the best one of the films that came out after the 60s series concluded. Now, I don't really need to talk about all the other films that were made because they just sort of lost their zest. Now, we loved them because we liked to see the original cast members act. But it wasn't until the mid-80s that Gene Roddenberry was invited back to the camp because someone said, we think we're going to do a television series. And this is where it got interesting. And remember, if you've seen either episode 7 or I believe 41, which is my other screenwriting rewriting episode, you have the dilemma that everybody really wants to write film because it's bigger and more massive and more epic in its production value. But in the end, if you're trying to tell a story, the very best thing you can do is write for television, because you can do a television series for years and years and years. Now, obviously, the first show was done in the 60s. It was a television show. Plenty of time to evolve these characters. But in the mid-80s, they contacted Gene, and there's a great documentary by William Shatner about the Gene Roddenberry era of bringing back the series on television. And there's a lot of, you know, legal shenanigans going on, and I guess Gene had a really weird attorney that... just really injected himself in the process, right? But this allowed Gene to take 15 years plus of his thought process about the franchise and give it a whole new spin with a whole new cast and get us the prime directive, really define what the world was like in the future, which is kind of where I think we're ebbing in our own sort of truth or objectives. Now, it's, you know, 2400, so it's like 400 years beyond where we are today, which I think is actually a very realistic, if we were to ever get rid of these jerk-offs that keep us from the latest zero-point energy, anti-gravity stuff that's out there. And for those of you who are new to this show, the patent office won't allow people to patent things of zero-point energy and zero-gravity machines because the military-industrial complex has to go first, and they don't want us to have these things because free energy causes massive populations explosions, and it allows us to create things that might challenge the military-industrial complex. You know, if you had a little tiny box that has infinite power, well, you could probably create a little railgun in your backyard, just put grains of sand in it, and you could probably shoot a satellite out of the sky, right? So they don't want that level of technology to be in our hands. So meanwhile, we constantly drill oil out of the bowels of the earth and fight over it, right? Just another thing that they happen to enjoy. Something that Gene was very, very aware of. But you have this new cast pulled out of an incredible search to to find all the perfect characters to build this, what is Star Trek Next Generations, which launched in 1987, which is the year I came to California. So the reason why I missed most of the Next Generations is because I was actually 18 years old moving to California and starting my life and didn't own a television until probably, I guess, 92. You know, I had rented rooms and things and homes that had TVs, but I just was working constantly. I almost never, ever watched a television show. But what I didn't realize was that the evolution of the show was utterly phenomenal. It wasn't until I saw the William Shatner special on Netflix, which you can see for free. He's done two. He did one called The Captains, which is where he, being a captain himself, he went and interviewed all the captains of all the different series that went on television and really exposed the fact that filming these shows was laborious, you know, extremely long, aggressive shooting schedules from Monday through Friday, working, you know, potentially 14-hour days. On occasion, people who, you know, didn't get a chance to engage their family members, their spouses, and so they really paid a huge price to be on this show. But of course, like we all know, after maybe 5 or 6 years of being on any one of the Star Trek shows, you're set for life, you know. At least I hope so. But with this, we get the Prime Directive. The Prime Directive is, for those of you who are new to Star Trek, is this idea that we don't just visit other planets that aren't at our level. And it goes back to my Alien Promise episode. If you haven't seen that, you might enjoy it if you like the Star Trek thing. But that's the whole idea, that we want to have some magical group of people come down to our world and just gift us with everything, right? And here's, again, zero-point energy, anti-gravity, cures to cancer. You know, instead of us being responsible beings and evolving, but when kicking out these bankers that run the world and evolving everything up, back to where we were in the atomic era, getting rid of all this stupid Prussian education agendas and fixing our little communities and being sensible about population growth and just taking ownership like adults, because we're a bunch of children running a planet right now, right? And the only adults that are trying to contribute to the methods of how the world's run are corrupt, sociopathic, elitist bankers, right? So what Gene said was there's a rule. It's called the Prime Directive, and that is that we, under no circumstance, contact pre-warp civilizations. Now, what does that mean? For those of you new to Star Trek, it means as soon as a civilization reaches light speed, warp 1, they then get immediately visited, one, because they have the ability to travel the stars effectively. So when the fictional character, Zefron Cochrane, inside the Star Trek franchise, achieves warp 1, and he's this drunken, you know, master. He sits and listens to a jukebox all day. I forget the gentleman who plays his character, but I honestly had a problem with the first version of this character that eventually grew on me. But he hits warp 1, and that's when the Vulcans land on Earth, and boom, we have, you know, interstellar communication with our galaxy and our little quadrant of the galaxy. We meet the people who also live out there. Now, of course, in the series, you have this beautiful, probably at least 24 episodes across the next 15 years, where the Prime Directive is, you know, from time to time, they bend the rule a little bit, or a mistake happens, and someone, what they'll end up doing to pre-warp civilizations is they go into high orbit and shield themselves in such a way that no one can sense them down below. A lot of times a very primitive culture with no technology to check anybody in orbit, right? But they stay up there and then they beam people down after doing some cosmetic surgery to them to make them look exactly like the indigenous race down there. And they'll just essentially figure out, hey, how are they doing? You know, are you into war yet? Are you into peace yet? How's your education? How do you culturally get along? And every once in a while, something happens. Some random event will occur and they get discovered. And the, you know, doctors will do scans on them and find out that they aren't really made of the same stuff. And then there has to be a rescue mission. And so you have this interesting, you know, violation of the Prime Directive, which is very interesting. So the nice thing about the Prime Directive and Star Trek is that you have Gene and company, all these incredible writers that wrote with the franchise, exploring what man would do if we had the power to do so. So these arcs are very important to what might end up happening to us, right? If we have UFOs out there watching us with alien races, what the crew of this Next Generations and beyond did was explore the psyche of what that would really be and the social responsibilities and precautionary rules that might be in place before contacting a civilization that doesn't have warp or some form of advanced technology. Now, something I just realized because of this special on Netflix, which warms my heart dearly. You'll hear me talk in the episode about the, anytime I talk about heaven, I'll talk about the Q Continuum, which is a reference to this a fictional race in the Star Trek television series of the 80s, okay? What I found out is that Gene hadn't planned to create that particular race. And what ended up happening was in 1987, they told Gene, you know, the premiere's got to be 2 hours. We need to really kick this thing off beautifully, which I actually was very encouraged that the studios were forcing the 2 hours because I would imagine the writer would want 2 hours premieres. But Gene was violently opposed to a 2-hour premiere because they'd already written the script and locked it, and it was going to be a big deal to figure out what the hell to say. So through some money shifting and some protesting, they convinced Gene to go ahead and do a 2-hour series, to take the script they had and bump it up another 50 minutes or so, right? And as it's told in this special, Gene Roddenberry took the script and wrote in the Q Continuum, this Q character that kind of puts the whole theme on Next Generations, which is this test to see if man is worthy of existing. Which is very interesting. It's a very godlike thing to do. Do you, you know, are you worthy of keeping in the universe? Are you just another barbaric culture of ignorance? And of course, Patrick Stewart, who plays Jean-Luc Picard, is probably the best character on planet Earth to handle such a challenge, you know? But to find out that that brilliant, brilliant character, Q, which shows up in every single television series until the very end, I believe. Although I can't remember exactly how he appears in Enterprise. But he is just this playful, omnipotent, godlike creature. And everybody who's in the Q Continuum has that ability. And for those of you who missed the episode, and again, just go back and watch them all. Two series past Next Generation. So I'm going to go through each one that I and kind of cover what I think is important about these episodes or these shows. When you get to Voyager, there's a Q episode where a different Q shows up. He was one of my favorite comedic actors from the 70s. He was one of the main characters in the movie called Used Cars. He shows up and he wants to commit suicide. And Captain Janeway is trying to figure out, why are you trying to commit suicide? We usually don't help people commit suicide because there's always a reason to live. And he says, well, I need to show you what the Q Continuum looks like so you understand what I'm dealing with. And he talks to Q and they have a little powwow, and they realize that there is a visual metaphor for showing people what it's like to be in the continuum, because they live in this sort of more, I think, energy-based ethereal existence in the universe, which sounds very much like a heaven, right? But he shows them that being a Q continuum person means that you live forever, you have all powers, and eventually you've done everything once. You've had every conversation you could possibly have. You've engaged in every theme of existence. And eventually, you want to commit suicide. And that's what I think heaven would be if Christians ever got what they're asking for, you know. It was that episode that made me believe in reincarnation more than ever. That in order to avoid being that guy that remembers everything about everything that's ever been done, you have to reset. We have to reset. There's no reason for us. There's no need to die, right? There's no need to actually physically as a consciousness cease to exist. What would be the point in that? I don't understand the point in that. But you do, if you live forever, need to go through a birth, life and death and resurrection cycle. And the reason why, you know, believing in Santa Claus feels so damn good is because you don't have the cynicism of being an adult to negate that belief system. So I think, you know, going in a circle is, might be the most beautiful thing that the universe could be. You know, Christians, for whatever reason, have, well, I think we know why, but they've demonized reincarnation because then the preachers who have this death grip on humanity no longer has the death grip on humanity, because someone just looks at the priest and goes, I'm going to die and I'm going to get resurrected. So step back. All right. There is no heaven. There is no nirvanic hell that it's a stateless world where I just eat cake every day. That's for your ignorant masses that want to let you control them. But as soon as I control my own mind and my own thought process, going in a loop is not a sin, right? Doing something great is not a sin. And you'll have some bad ones and some good ones, I'm sure, right? And some boring ones too. But now Gene dies in real life. He dies in the, I believe, the second year or so of Next Generations. So I want to give one more huge prop to his vision of the future. One of the big things that happens in one of the episodes is they actually have to violate the Prime Directive, and a woman, I believe, and I hope I'm not botching this, but a woman gets pulled up from her planet, and they put her in the Enterprise, that's in orbit around her planet. And she starts asking Jean-Luc Picard questions about the future, about where they're from. And he has an opportunity to admit to us that there is no money in the future. That humanity simply does what humanity needs to do. We find our purpose and we fulfill it. And there's no more crushing pressures from banking. There's no more usury from banking, which is compound interest rates on loans, on credit cards. That's just erased. And people still go to Starfleet, and they still study, and they still fall in love, and they still get their hearts broken, and they still die. And it's just a normal planet, a normal civilization. But it's beautiful and finally perfect. And I want to stop there for 1 second, because there's this weird thing that society it's an act of pure ignorance, in my opinion. People get all righteous about suffering. This is going to dovetail with something else, but for those of us who were into rap music in the 80s, and yes, I said rap music, the 80s rap, at least up to about 88 or so, were rappers that lived in a lot of cases, not the best worlds. The ghettos of New York, the ghettos of LA, and they rapped. And they rapped about a world that they wanted to live in. Or they created like comedic themes. You know, like Run DMC's You Talk Too Much. They created these comedy themes so that we had a little bit of relief from life. But in a lot of cases, it was about rapping about a life that was worth living. A vision of the future that isn't what we have today. Or it's a beautiful world that this rapper has particularly accomplished, right? Pulled himself out of the ghetto, or herself out of the ghetto, and made a great life for themselves. And it was sort of a beacon for a lot of kids to listen to this music and go for it. Now, rock and roll was all, you know, love songs and that kind of stuff. But rap had a very interesting theme to it. And then the 90s came around, or 89, I think, when NWA came out. Again, this is great. The other music's great, too. The hardcore stuff is really great, too. But there was this switch in theme, which was to bring darkness. Put a lens down on the ghetto as if the population didn't know what was going on. You know, and I guess some cases maybe we didn't know how ghettos were getting roughed up by police and that kind of stuff in the Midwest or something like that. So a little bit of truth was revealed. But instead of revealing it in a way that says, you know, we should positively get out of this thing, it was negative, 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 and it really eroded the culture. It took bad habits in bad areas due to repression and pushed it up into neighborhoods that were perfectly fine, to the point where guys, you know, were calling women bitches and weird stuff like that. So you had this acidic overflow out of these bad areas put into culture. you know. And I just think it turned into grunge music. It turned into being less than the best was the way you're supposed to go. Like excellence and being tightly dressed and all that kind of stuff. No matter how you did what you did, it was flushed down the drain to pretend like you were, you know, in an apocalyptic era. It was weird. Now, why mention such a weird thing? Because Gene Roddenberry also was brought up in that world where the best way to make a better world is to create a vision that is clear, concise, precise, and something that a culture that watches that story can strive for, right? We strive for the Star Trek world if you're part of the Star Trek franchise. Like as soon as you start seeing Next Generations, you start going, well, geez, that's where we need to be. I don't know how to get there, but that's where we need to be. Walt Disney was that way as well. You know, a lot of people criticized in my lifetime, they criticized television shows about families. And I remember Leave It to Beaver and Brady Bunch when I was a kid in the 80s and 90s was highly criticized. And by just people in my circles, I don't remember exactly who, but I remember asking, well, why do you not like those shows? And they said, because life wasn't like that. That wasn't the real world. And so when you think about feedback loops between people, between societal factions, that is the point. You're in a negative feedback loop, perhaps, in society because we haven't evolved to where we need to be. And these shows give you an idea of where it could be if you could all communicate well, you know, if you could be empathetic and sympathetic towards people. And, you know, these shows portrayed the mistakes that we're making, but then they always resolve them. And that's what Star Trek does, is they portray the mistakes that we make. You know, there's plenty of times when, look at every episode of Brady Bunch or Leave It to Beaver, you have someone doing something wrong at the beginning in the first 5 minutes, and then it's the secret that's held for 20 minutes, and then it resolves, and, you know, we all learn the moral of the story is not to tell lies or not to do something weird. That's most of the archetypes of all those stories, you know? So what Gene did was brilliant. He said, every race we encounter is going to have the negative themes of what society is today, and the Star Trek crew is the advanced society that comes in and proves that there's a better way. And then on top of the whole thing, the brilliance is the Q is accusing mankind of being the regressed, unevolved race, the monkey men, you know. And so we have to defend ourselves in this episode between, I think it was like, gosh, I want to say 5 or 6 years that the Next Generations went, you know, because I believe it was overlapped with Deep Space Nine, which came after that, you know. And, you know, if you get hooked on these, especially I think you can use Netflix to watch most of them nowadays, it, at the end of each one of the series, except for Enterprise, they knew that they were done with the series and they created a truly exciting episode, which is always heart-wrenching. You know, when you see the last episode of Star Trek Enterprise, it is just awful. You know, it's like it's great, but it's awful. You don't want it to end. But the nice thing is they went off and started creating movies, of course, right? And the movies that came out of Next Generations, which is the only franchise to get a movie after the initial series, right, in the 60s, you have them deeply engaging the storyline from the show. So the Zephyr and Cochrane story is a movie, which is beautiful. So they have the budgets and they really kicked it out great, you know. And the Borg became phenomenal. The Borg was invented in Next Generations. It was tremendous, right? Now, so before I button up on Next Generations, because we're going to go a lot faster for the other series, what you will find in Next Generations is a lot of agenda-based science. You know, they have... What'll end up happening in episodes in Star Trek is they recall global history of Earth. And for instance, you'll hear there was a cabal on Freon. DuPont created Freon, and DuPont was losing the patent on Freon in the early 80s. And DuPont, they funded this whole hysteria about ozone layer stuff, right? Hysteria. And so the whole deal, I mean, if you remember being in the late 80s, early 90s, it was all about the ozone layer burning off. And that was all paid for by the DuPont organization that made Freon. Now, why would they do that? Because DuPont wanted, they were losing their patent on it, so it was getting into the public domain. So anybody could make Freon. And this is a huge, huge multi-billion dollar industry for DuPont. So what they ended up doing was demonizing through the legislation. They paid senators to demonize Freon and come up with this crazy ozone layer thing, which for flat earth people, that's really funny, right? So they said there's this big hole. Then DuPont said that got the legislation passed that said the only thing you can replace Freon with is DuPont's new patented substance, which I forgot what the hell it's called. And there's still a few states in the union that allow you to use Freon. And, or there's places you can hide and use it. But I know, we know some Hollywood car designers and manufacturers that make all the futuristic cars, and they are out in deserts because they end up using Freon for reasons that I'm unaware of. So there's definitely an episode where Data, who's this android, will recall the history of the past. And he'll say, well, you know, back in the 20th century, mankind had so abused the atmosphere that they created a hole in the ozone layer, da-da-da-da-da. And so that freezes in time and factually backs up propaganda. So that does get slipped in from time to time. But I think that honestly, if you just have sort of, well, we had a pre-internet writing crew, they couldn't do an easy search on the DuPont cabal. And, you know, incandescent light bulbs right now just got the same DuPont treatment. So the reason why we have safe, low-energy lights demonized and these toxic, mercury-filled, horrible light bulbs and their replacement is because there's a patent for that. And Edison had his patent on the light bulb expired nearly a century ago. So the reason why you have these ridiculous light bulbs that are totally unhealthy for your psyche and they're considered toxic spills when they break on the ground, right? As soon as one of those little coiled light bulbs burns out or breaks on the ground, which is why they're super thick glass, your family is being exposed to particles of mercury. It's like breaking a thermometer open. You know, get LED light bulbs if you have to, but none of that's good for your body. You know, with an incandescent light bulb, you have an AC motor at your power plant driving voltage to a filament in the light bulb, which creates nice continuous light. It's just as natural as candlelight. The second they put an LED or one of these kind of gas light bulbs, they can control your state of mind from the AC generator by flickering it. So remember when people who are epileptic see certain flickers, they go into convulsions and seizures, right? Well, every human being has a bit of that in their system. And so they can actually vary the AC power supply and vary literally the frequency of light that you see. And remember with LEDs and fluorescent light bulbs, you're 50% in the dark and 50% in the light, but they modulate the beam every 60th of a second such that you feel like you're in the light, which is why when you use fluorescent bulbs in your office or you go to an office with fluorescent bulbs, you just feel bizarre. And when and the beautiful example for all of you is most of you have been at work with fluorescent light bulbs over your head and your building loses power. And the second it loses power, you have this amazing phantom tension lift off your body. And that's because those light bulbs just went dead. For those of us who develop video games and we go and work at corporations that have to host hundreds of us, thousands of us in buildings, we don't use fluorescent lights. One, because it just obliterates our psyche to create games and think creatively. But the other half is that it blows out our monitors in a way that we can't really see true light on the screen. So as we're studying color palettes for artwork or watching the mood of the game, we kill those lights. But don't put those lights around you if you can help it, right? Go replace every single one of them. You can still find incandescent light bulbs online. Buy crates of them. They're not that expensive. And buy the ones that are supposed to last 5 to 10 years, and you won't replace them all the time. Okay, back to the series. So I'm just going to skim over the next few series here. Deep Space Nine is about a Bajoran race that was in a big giant battle with the Cardassians. And this war is over, and there's this Bajoran base, this really exotic-looking space base that floats in space. And because of the agreement, the treaty of ending this war, the Federation, which is the humans, have gained access to the space. They are running this base as a nice proxy between all of the warring factions to sort of calm everything down. Now, that series struggled for the first two seasons. And it struggled because the formula of the cast was a little wonky at first. And they have this Bajoran security chief, Kira, who was told to overplay her character tremendously, to be very, and they wrote everything where she was just on edge and she hated the Cardassians, and it just got to the point where this character was utterly annoying to be on screen. And she's a fabulous actress, and they calmed her down beautifully, and it all became great. And you know, you end up disliking her for the first couple series, at least I did, most of my friends did, and then by the third or fourth season she's endearing and one of your favorite characters, right? But they really pushed the envelope on introducing new races. Right now, they invent a shape-shifting race with one guy named Odo, who doesn't know where he's from. He keeps looking for where he's from. He takes human form, but he's not human. And he can't quite get it right, so his face is really smooth. So if you see that guy, that's what that story is. Then they really push forward the Ferengi race, which showed up in Next Generations, I believe, but they have this bartender named Quark, which if you've studied quantum physics, you'll understand when they got his name. But he's an amazing actor, and becomes an incredibly endearing character you love to see, but he's always scheming in the background. He's sort of your black market dude. You have a Cardassian tailor who fixes suits, but he's actually an ex-spy of the Cardassian army, and you don't have any idea where his loyalties lie for quite some time. And then you have, for the first time, and I hate to even say it like this because it shouldn't matter whatsoever, but you have a black captain. And he plays Benjamin Sisko, a guy named Avery, the heck is his name? It's Avery something or other. But he, in real life, he's a really kooky guy. It's really interesting. He's this jazz pianist and stuff, but he adds a whole nother caliber to Captain, I think, and just does an amazing job. And he has a son. You have a ship's doctor, of course. You have a symbiotic science officer, which is a race of a woman that has to take the symbiotic creature into her belly. And she essentially has the consciousness of this creature that has existed for hundreds of years. And her predecessor, who owned this symbiotic life force, was a dude who was actually best friends with the captain in the previous life. So she's now serving on Deep Space Nine. So the captain and this hot chick, who I think she was a beauty queen and model at one point, she's a fabulous actress. I mean, just everybody's actually fantastic, but this woman nails it, right? You might think, you're some model trying to become an actress. Well, she really nails this thing. So Benjamin and her have this weird relationship, as he's kind of the old army buddy, but he's also this hot chick, which is funny. But they bring in all the traditional races, the Klingons and the Vulcans and the Romulans and all this other stuff over the course of the series, which I believe that one went for 5 years. And there's a little pipsqueak kid who grows up to be this massive child who's actually taller than his father. That he starts out, I think, 10 or 11 years old, and he ends up being a teenager, and I think he's like 6 foot something by the time it's over. So he's towering over all the other characters. But the interesting thing is that they brought all these different races together, and the conflict between their histories, which we have a lot of that on planet Earth. You know, if you were to bring an Israeli and a Palestinian inside of a series on television today, like Taxi 2.0, and they both drive taxis, and they're both going at each other's throats about what they've been indoctrinated to believe, right? It's a valuable exercise for humanity to see them resolve their issues, right? And so there's just tumultuous scenes forever. But if you get into Deep Space Nine and you're not quite into the tension that's in the first few episodes you see in episode one, go to episode three and just start watching. And then you can backtrack to one and you'll be all right. You'll be missing a lot of the backstory. But sometimes, as one of my artists said in my company, she said, sometimes the best way to get into a new series is to not watch the first episode. It's to watch some point in the second or third season. So when they've got, the writers have got their groove on, right, and work this thing out. Now the final season of that gets a little, it's a little dark because the Klingons become a big deal. And, I believe Worf comes in and Dorn, I forget his first name. He comes in and plays Worf, which is the Klingon that was in the weapons dude in Enterprise, and just he just nails his character everywhere he goes. But he has an amazing character in the Deep Space Nine, and there's a rumor that he's in the new 2017 episodes, but we'll see. Everyone's still alive pretty much from the television series, so they should be able to bring them in, and they could even bring in Shatner and a few of the, well, actually, Shatner, I guess, is one of the only originals besides Uhura. And George Takei, I guess there's four of them left, right? You guys are yelling at the screen here. I think it's Michael Dorn, right? But the end gets very involved with the Klingon Empire and a struggle for honor with the Worf character. And, you know, you sort of lose the beautiful racial, it's like different species, really. It's not really different races, but this beautiful duality of hearing everyone's story constantly is a little bit lost. But there's great resolves. By the time the last episode airs, again, you're choked up. You're just like, damn it, this is over, and it just got perfect again, right? Soon after that, you get Voyager. And Voyager was very tough for me to get into, but then I ended up utterly loving it. Voyager's got an interesting storyline because they have, you know, they've done Star Trek 60s series. They've done the Next Generations, which, you know, advanced it all up into the 24th century, which is, I believe, 100 years beyond where the first episodes aired. Then you have Deep Space Nine, which is the same time period, but you have this sort of this Bajoran Cardassian race thing that's sort of catalyzing everything that's going on the base. And then you have Voyager, same time frame. So how do you do another series? How do you not make all these guys bump into each other? You know, well, they did a brilliant, brilliant thing. And one of the early series, or the first season, excuse me, first episode, you have the ship going on a test flight. And then Q shows up. And Q and Captain Janeway get in a bit of an argument. And he zaps them deep into the galaxy. And you find out that there's this thing called the Caretaker in this big structure. And essentially they get hurled like 35,000 light years from Earth. And now they got to make it back home. And Janeway, which is really funny, this is where it gets a little insane. She's so prideful that she won't take Q's offer to take them back to Earth and basically save everybody's life, as I remember it, right? So now it's a mechanism. It's beautiful, right? So now they're struggling to get home. And now they're in a Delta sector of the galaxy, I believe. And so they are hauling ass back home and having to figure out ways to travel faster, deal with all the cultural implications, and it's the new story. Now, the cast and crew is actually very interesting in this new series because you have this this rebel faction that was sort of against the Starfleet area, and they think the place got a little too socialistic, and so they are fighting back. And this rebel force is called the Maquis, and they just happen to be in this fold when everyone gets sent deep into deep space. And so in order to save them and not be murderers, they have to take this Maquis onto the Enterprise, which I always thought looked like a toilet bowl lid. I never was very, very turned on by the Voyager one, but you got to design something different. Sometimes it just doesn't appeal to everyone, right? But this guy named Chakotay, he's a Native American, which I was so happy they found a way to put a Native American in anything, right? He ends up sort of becoming the number one, you know, the number one sidekick to the captain, Janeway. Now, this episode, because they're so stuck in space and they're not going to be visiting any Earth bases, they really super duper lean on the holodeck as a way to keep people from going insane. And so there's a lot of amazing holodeck evolutions and recreational things that go on in this. And there was plenty of that in the previous series, but they really just take it to a new level in this one. Now, this show, I think, has, I think it was the first or second show where, everyone was concerned that there was going to be a female captain and whether or not this woman could pull it off. Because it's hard. It's hard to have all that pressure on you from three previous captains that just nailed it, and now they're putting this on her shoulder. But I tell you what, this woman absolutely kills it. And I'm going to get her name here real quick. Yeah, Kate Mulgrew just kills us, you know, in my opinion. But there was an episode at the very beginning where Kate and this Klingon woman, she's half human, half Klingon, she becomes the head of engineering. Yeah, B'Elanna Torres is the name of her character, and the actress's name is Ruxan Dawson, I guess is her name. But there was an interesting scene where they were trying to deduce how to get out of a particular problem, and they had to use warp particles, right? But instead of just saying warp particles, you actually have a frame shot where Janeway's face comes in from one side and this B'Elanna Torres character comes in on the other side, and they say in unison, warp particles. If you're a writer of Star Trek, that's when I turned your series off and never watched it for 20 years. Okay. I was just like, this is ridiculous. You took the perceived weakness of women and just threw it into the episode at one of the very first scenes, and I just dialed out because it was like, come on, guys. If you had a similar problem, which you probably didn't, there's never an occurrence of that again. That never happens again in the entire series, and it becomes an amazing series. Voyager is one of my favorite series of the whole bunch. Now, in all series of Star Trek, you have someone that's supposed to overact and be sort of the wild card tension that creates a lot of reasons to do episodes, right? With Star Trek Next Generations, you had the character that played Riker. He was always the boisterous, cantankerous, you know, I think you're wrong, Captain, and blah, 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 and he's always just overacting his things. But that's exactly what he's supposed to do. And he became this, I think, a fairly decent director in his life, too. He's a brilliant guy in real life, but he knew exactly what he was doing, and that was just how he did it. When you get into Deep Space Nine, you have this Kira character who is just overacting and over-exaggerating, and she's just like, I'm totally offended constantly, so you must obey what I say. Just constantly living in the past of her war-torn world, because she was a rebel fighter in this Bajoran group that fought the Cardassians. She was in a labor camp, so she had been really tortured. But that just got old after a while. Two seasons of this girl, and whenever she's on the set, it was like, oh, how is she going to get offended in this next 2 seconds here? And here it was, boom, always on the mark, right? By the time you get to Voyager, you have a little bit of Maquis Federation friction, and there's a female character that ends up causing a lot of problems. You have your female Klingon, who is struggling with her psyche because she's got this kind of wild card Klingon blood in her, but then she's got this human blood. So every time she gets pissed off as a human, she flips into her Klingon blood and beats the shit out of some guy, which is interesting. But you have a character named Tom Paris, who was a sort of the Riker-type character, but he was a Maquis. He's one of the best pilots in Starfleet, and so he's obviously given the job to drive this vehicle. But throughout the episodes, he's sort of the wild card, the schemer, and he creates a lot of incredible tension. For me, that arc just went a little too far in the episode. Like, he never calmed down, you know. So, no slight to the actor. He was doing exactly what he was supposed to do, and he nailed it. But for me, that was the only part that had a little bit of tension. The reason why I'm mentioning these little tension points with these characters, not just to pick on something, but by the time Star Trek Enterprise was greenlit in September 2001, you got a challenge. What are you going to do? Another series? Was it going to dovetail on the end of Voyager? And then you have all these pre-existing conditions with the Borg and all this other stuff. No, it's a prequel. It is a before the 60s series with the very first NS1 Enterprise. Scott Bakula plays Captain Archer. For me, and Brandon Braga, I believe, had quite a bit to do with this particular one. And Berman, all those guys. But they created the most balanced crew of any of the Star Trek series that ever hit television. And by the way, it's the only one that's in HD widescreen as well. So it's a really fun series to watch because it's just gorgeous. If you're a guy, I can tell you that Star Trek Enterprise was the very first series that I could get a girl to watch who wasn't a nerd. And it became, when is the next episode on? When's the next episode on? It became something that was looked forward to in just a normal, non-nerdy person's take on Star Trek. So that's one of the great benefits of that show. But for me, the tension was always there between characters, but it was almost, it was just very respectful disagreements about things. And this series went through a tremendous amount of interesting history of planet Earth, as a matter of fact. And the first, there's only four seasons of it. As I remember, for the first three seasons, you have pretty much the normal flow of episodes where you might have a couple that cliffhang to each other. They did the opposite negative universe where everyone has, you know, a little Fu Manchu mustaches and they're all evil, which is weird. But that's actually, they just do a brilliant job with it. I think they did that with Deep Space Nine as well. I can't remember if they did that with Voyager or not. But that's always sort of the homage to the original series back in the 60s where they had that first originated, right, with Gene. But towards the end of this series, you have a couple things that were very, very interesting. They are, it's the very first time that man has ever gone into deep space, for one. So you don't have multiple NS series deep space exploration vehicles. Only this particular vehicle, if I remember it right. So there's no epic battles in space because there's no epic fleet yet, you know. But believe me, they deliver. But they find out that there is an anomaly where people, there's a few alien races in the galaxy that end up believing that, that something that bad happened in their history was the responsibility of mankind, humans. So they developed this council that that meets and says that humanity must die. Humanity must completely die. And they create this horrible weapon. It's this ball that flies over to Earth, pops out of like warp, flies to Earth, and hits Earth with this big laser beam and starts cutting this massive line in Earth. It's like a mile wide or something like that. But it runs like 11 miles or something on, it's like Florida where they nail it. I think that's it. I think but in my brain, it was a lot longer beam, but it kills like 10 million people plus, maybe 11 millions of people, amount of people that get killed. But one of the crew members loses a sister in the attack. And this race is called the Zindi. And so the whole last series is really taken up with this episodical cliffhanging series about negotiating with the Zindi, finding out who the Zindi are, trying to figure out who thinks that humans are bad, because Scott Bakula's got the whole planet Earth on his back to say, I'm going to convince these people not to attack us, and I'm going to prove to them that we're good people. Now, what's cool about this is they just do a brilliant job, and they give Scott Bakula probably some of the most difficult speeches to portray on camera, where he's really got to give a speech that convince a whole collection of arguing races that humanity isn't the threat, that what they thought was something that humanity did to them was actually another race. I believe that's the way it works. But they resolve it, and there's a couple shows after the resolve, and then the series is canceled. But one of the brilliant things that they did was they took this crew that after the whole Zindi thing is resolved, they come back to Earth and spend some time. And, you know, everyone's getting some Shipley. But everyone has sort of a PTSD formula of anxiety based on having to deal with this bone-crushing responsibility that, one, they sort of inadvertently blame themselves for having stirred up the pot of not knowing how to communicate with foreign, you know, species. And the interesting thing about it that they dovetailed in beautifully is that the Prime Directive didn't exist. And so they just walk onto a planet. But at the time, they were trying to like, well, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe we should. There should be some standards, you know. Which is interesting because when the Vulcans landed, they said, "Because you got warp, we communicated with you." Okay, and they do have a a small thing that's like the Prime Directive, and they do try to keep from polluting, you know, societies. But in the end, the occupants of Earth become extremely xenophobic about alien races, and they blame Starfleet for having stirred up this whole pot. And the very final episode is about this guy who played, was it Future Cop or whatever the hell his name is? I'm just drawing a blank right now, but he was an actor in the 70s or in the 80s that played the, I guess Future Cop, right? You're going to kill me if I got that wrong. But anyway, he is a billionaire who is going to shut down Starfleet by doing this crazy attack. And he's trying to screw up a lot of their space bases and research centers to make sure that Starfleet slows down and doesn't go out and create another Zindi attack. And of course, there's plenty of people on Earth that are like, we lost 10, 11 million people on planet Earth due to this attack. And everybody lives in fear of terrorism from foreign enemies. And so they're trying to shut the whole thing down. Just let the bee's nest calm down. And the crew are having nightmares and stuff like this, that they're still being pursued by these folks. And it's tough. So I think that's interesting because that's sort of where we are today. But instead of being alien races, we have just different, you know, races on Earth that we're conditioned to hate and fear. And we have these pockets that get so terrified, and they have such such a lack of education about other cultures. Even with the internet, they don't reach on the internet and try to figure out what Muslims are about, or the fact that there's peaceful ones and barbaric ones, and the differences between Persians and Iraqian people. And there's just, you know, we don't know anything about these folks, but we're absolutely gung-ho green-lighting murdering them with drones and sorties and invasions. Right? So Gene was onto something when he started this series, and he was trying to pitch a positive view of the future that we could strive for. If we don't have a vision, like if you start a company, right? I don't care if you got three employees, right? And you're just delivering flowers or cheese wheels or whatever the hell you're doing. You have to figure out what makes you different than your competition. And you can't succeed unless there is something different about your you and your competition, something that's perceivably better than your competition, right? But you have to infuse that vision into your employees such they carry your sentiment with them, right? You know, when you go into an Apple store, as frustrating as it is to be in these Apple stores with all these sort of like almost drugged out Kool-Aid drinking kids who, you know, Apple's the best. Well, at least they think Apple's the best. At least they believe in their products, right? You know, Microsoft never really had those stores until the late 90s, and every single one of them went out of business. It was crazy, right? But think of any brand that you love that has a name behind it. It's because you have that brand loyalty I talked about in the fanboy episode. But instead of making it a brand, why don't we make it a vision of the future? And I think that's the core of what the truthers are trying to do, right? We want to end to corruption. We want to end to hatred. And we want a way that we can make the world a better place. And so the entire reason for doing this episode is that I want to, if you haven't ingested all the Star Trek episodes, it is a great training wheel for the mind to get a vision that is sustained over hundreds of hours of episodes, such that we can usurp these fictional characters into our own soul and really feel like if you're able to watch a show and climb into it, you know, and really feel it for a while, and you go to bed at night thinking, man, I just want to be on the Star Trek Enterprise for a day. If you start getting that feeling that it's a real place in your psyche, now you got to be careful, it'll brainwash you too. But I think if you're a truther, you know what to watch out for, right? And a lot of that agenda stuff sort of calms down by Enterprise, right? But it's a great place to wake up. You know, again, in the 60s, to recap, the 60s are going to be about a lot of the archetypes of the ruling class controlling the masses. And again, the third series gets a little funny. So watch the third series with open eyes that Gene Roddenberry is no longer involved. He quit. The movies, they're movies. They don't really have any giant themes you need to carry along. It's really about the characters and the franchise itself. But once you get into 1987, Next Generations, which I believe is free on Netflix, You'll start to see this beautiful new world that Gene had created in his mind 15 years after the episodes were finished in the 60s. And you can tell the guy really was thinking the entire time he was alive. You know, that guy has a lot of, you know, positive and negatives about him in terms of, you know, he essentially, I think, died of alcoholism. He drank his body away, which if you're a big drinker, think about it, right? And I'm smoking a cigar and you think, well, Walt Disney died of cigarettes. Rod Serling died of cigarettes. So be careful. So again, I don't inhale these, just so you know. Doesn't completely absolve my problem, but there's no chemicals in this, just tobacco. You know, there's, just to close this thing off, when I talk to my closest friends who are struggling with a goal, and any of you out there struggling with, you know, a goal that's hard, could be painting a painting, could be starting a business, could be building something brand new. I think it, one of my first five episodes, I talked about this a little bit, but you have to trick your mind sometimes to follow through with things. Tony Robbins' big idea is to create a vision of what the future will be if you succeed at your goal. So he says, put that vision in your mind of how great life will be if you finish that goal. That's a way to do it. If that particular technique works for you, it's great. I find it a little difficult to hang on to those end products, those end goal visions. I just think it's depending on how many months and years you have to keep that trick going. It's sometimes the attrition of playing games with your mind doesn't really work. That's just for me. I will end up playing tricks with my mind where I create a scenario where I sort of repaint my whole life that I'm actually already at that successful level. And I live in the bubble of, well, this is what I do. And I give an example. Let's say you're trying to write the next best novel or movie that's going to be released. All right. Now, what would happen now if you're an amateur and you're going for that profession, meaning you pay all your bills with what that is, what that skill is, you're putting yourself in sort of that, I would love to win the lottery, but I know I can't feeling. And you're trying to convince yourself that you're going to pick the right numbers. It's a little tougher on the soul, right? But what if somehow you're in a time machine and you get to go back to 1972, let's just say, and you have the scripts for Star Wars 1, 2, and 3 in your mind, which is 4, 5, and 6, right? And you're like, I've got these in my back pocket. I just need to get these to 20th Century Fox. I need to get these to George Lucas. I need to get them to the people that are going to buy them off of me, and I will be the creator of this trilogy that changed the world. All right. Now, let's say that you sell those, and of course they're being made. You're not one of the actors. You're not one of the directors. You're not part of making the film. And the script's locked. You delivered it perfect, right? So you get a ton of cash. Now, your goal might just be to go live on a tropical island and just chill out. But if what you're really trying to do is be a writer in real life, and you've already turned in these three amazing scripts, now you have the reputation of writing great scripts, even though you didn't write them yourself. All right. Well, now, you're sitting pretty. You got your home. You got plenty of time. You got your word processors, your screenwriting software, and you got a bunch of ideas, which is why you did this little trick in the first place. And you're thinking, all I need is the time to write what I need to write. And I need the reputation such that what I write is read no matter what, because I created these Star Wars films. Think about the pressure and the life that you're going to live after that moment. After you turn in these three scripts and you get this reputation for writing the greatest thing on earth, which you didn't. But you believe in yourself enough to write a fourth, something great, because you pre-planned this whole thing. If you wake up in that mindset and you just say, I've already got the success that I'm looking for, and now I just need to do the next one. It's not like the next film comes to you instantaneously or the next book comes to you instantaneously. You're still back to square one. You still have to create excellence over and over and over again. Right? So that's the game I like to play with myself, is to say, I've already succeeded once, and now Hollywood or whatever is looking at me and saying, fine, kid, you did a great job. We know how this works. Most people can't do it twice. You know, lightning in a bottle twice. So let's see what you can do. And you have to get up and convince yourself to be excellent again. You know, imagine all the members of Rolling Stones, all the members of Aerosmith. They have made nothing but great albums before, and now they have to make another great album. Imagine that pressure. Now they have innate talents and skills that they've manifested over the years, but in the end, they still have to come up with all the hooks. They have to find the energy to write, to record, to tour, etc. Well, that's us, you know? So that's the game I play. And so I find that the game is easier to play, one, if you surround yourself with people in the industry and keep very lucid about the challenges of whatever industry you're getting into. And again, this should be amazingly fun, honestly, right? But if you're a truther and you're just a person that's like, I want to make the world a better place, but I'm not sure what decisions we should make. How do we get, what state do we want to get to? Do we really want to get rid of free markets and get rid of money, which is like the Star Trek universe in 2400? That sounds like there's no competitiveness, there's no purpose to live. But somehow Gene wrote it in that everybody still has a purpose. It's just they're not brainwashed into money from the very moment they're born. They find a different way to be competitive, perhaps by the end product that they create as opposed to the money in the bank. So that's what I like about the Star Trek series, is it's like training wheels. It's literally like you take a camera and you push it 400 years in the future and you start taking pictures of what the world's like. What if you were able to go in a time machine and ride on the Star Trek Enterprise from Next Generations, and you were just, you just somehow could forge your way onto, you know, the cleanup crew? You're a janitor, so you don't need to know any special warp technology. You just need to know how to push a broom or a robot or whatever. And you're able to watch this universe exist. And then you're like, you come back here after a week of being there, and you're like, it does exist. It's amazing. And I don't know how the hell we're going to convince humans on Earth to be there, but we got to do it because this really works and this is where we're headed. I think you feel me. Anyway, a few things that are going on. I created a new Deep Thoughts Facebook page. It's Deep Thoughts Radio. So just go facebook.com/Deep Thoughts Radio. That's where we're going to harvest a lot of the thinking process, because the main radio show that we started, MK Ultra Radio, about, which is kind of sort of the Mark and Kyle show, it's one, our recording is way down because Kyle moved, he was 40 minutes north from me, and then he moved another 40 minutes north, and so we're now 80 minutes one way from each other, and it's just a little tough to do that in LA, because it's through the bowels of LA that I have to travel to get to him or him to me, and since I have to edit these things together. You know, if we do a 2-hour show together, I got to listen to the whole thing for 2 hours to make sure there's no flubs in it. But the thinking process and what we're trying to do on Deep Thoughts is so unique and different that I think what we're going to do is take the MKUltraRadio.com website, and it's going to be essentially a channel selector for shows that appeal to different audiences, right? So I normally point you at the Facebook link, but I've changed the website such that there's now a Deep Thoughts Facebook link at the top, and there's an MK Ultra Facebook link. So if you're into really heavy political conspiracies, the stuff that's very acidic in the world, beheadings, and you know all the the false flag stuff, MK Ultra Radio is the main show, is what you're interested in. And if you're into this more intellectual, you know, again, my three categories on the website is if you want to go to MKUltraRadio.com, if you click on the social category, you're going to get deep thoughts that relate to social issues, science for the science, and creativity for creativity. So that should help you find the deep thoughts that are really applied to your thinking process. And what's really weird is I didn't plan it this way, but every single episode is either a science, creativity, or social theme. It just worked out that way. It's kind of cool. But since we have a whole new following, if you find yourself more in line with the deep thoughts and not the normal show, which, again, from the comments, some people go back and forth between these two channels. It's going to be one YouTube channel. Like, it's like you're tuning into HBO, and there's multiple series in HBO. So what's going to happen is, if you're not a fan of the radio show, just don't listen to it. If you like this, listen to this, or vice versa, right? So, again, you know, what's beautiful about this is that these are truly deep thoughts, right? I went online and looked at all the deep thoughts YouTube videos that are out there of people using that phrase. And, you know, they're 5-minute videos, 11-minute videos. And I'm sure I could gain, you know, thousands of more subscribers if I could say something in 5 minutes, because that's the attention span of the world today. And no slight to them. They just want to get in and out and get some little tasty bits of thought. I'm going to keep long. because I think that it's self-regulating. I find the most astute people, great thinkers. You know, you guys in your comments are just fantastic. It's really cool to listen to you guys talk about stuff and link things. So the other thing is that what I want to do with the Deep Thoughts Facebook page is get us to start posting some of the more unique research, right? If you've got a conspiratorial video about the CERN Hadron Collider, go right there and post it. You know, join and post it in there. And again, what will happen is it goes off to a side feed. I see that, and I'll repost it into the main feed. And just so you guys know, the mobile devices sometimes compete with sharing what you post into the main forum. So sometimes I have to take your link and literally steal your link and post it into the page, depending on what device I'm on when I'm seeing your post, because I want to get it up there quickly. So if you're not credited for having shared this with us originally, it's just because of Facebook's apps that are all crazy and weird. So I've got an Android, a phone that I use, and I think I've resolved the issue, but there's Android phone, you know, Mac computer, which can do everything, and PC computers as well. And then I have tablets. And so they haven't synced all the features up, unfortunately. And of course they want us to use this page management app, which is just ridiculous. So I have like 50 apps on my phone. You know, it's like 3 for Facebook. So anyway, that's the scoop on that. So if you haven't gone already, go to mkultraradio.com to get all the feeds. Again, this is put in audio form. If you're coming in from audio, it's put into video form. I don't necessarily think you're going to sit and watch my face for 2 hours, but you can put it in the background on your computer and just let it play. You know, from time to time, episodes will have a lot of pictures in them. If I don't put pictures in, it's either I got overwhelmed, but I wanted the episode to be out there, or I feel like if I put certain pictures in, it might be a copyright issue. If I post a Deep Thoughts and it's blocked in your country, that is because the jerk-offs that own the music companies are blocking us from having the intro music and outro music on there. It's only been 2 occasions I've had the video entirely blocked. I use Michael Jackson, and obviously I understand why that gets blocked because he's a megastar, but I use Blur, this band that's no more in Britain that did Girls and Boys, and I wanted to put that inside the fanboy episode. So the podcast will sometimes have different intro music than the YouTube because the original concept doesn't get blocked in my MP3 format, but it gets blocked on the YouTube video. And the reason why that's entirely ridiculous to be blocked is that if they just use the recognition software, it promotes the sale of the song on a service to buy the song. So if I use just a snippet from that song, right? I'm not using even 20 seconds, maybe I'm using 30 seconds tops, right? 2 15-second intro outro things, and you like the song, you remember, oh, I do like that song, you would go buy it. But instead it gets blocked. It's stupid. Germany blocks almost everything, right? Whatever the companies and whatever arrangement they have with Germany, they're not willing to pay anything, or I don't know what the hell the problem is. But if you can't watch things in Germany from time to time, that's why. So if you're missing numbers in the YouTube feed, that's why. If you can get those missing numbers through the podcast. So just use a third-party podcast listener, because if you use iTunes, again, you only get the last 9 episodes. We're in the deep 60s now. So if you can only get 9, think about how many you're missing. You're missing 50 minimum, right? Plenty of new ideas coming. I am going to be knocking these out a little quicker. And sometimes I'll do this episode and I feel like it's strong and I feel like it's relevant. And I'm trying to make sure that there's social creativity and science kind of going back to back. So if I sit on the patio and I do 3 in a row that are social, I'm going to do 1 2 weeks later that's scientific, and I'm going to put it in there in between. So if you see my hair color change or my hair's length change, that's probably because it's an old episode that I just held back, either for production value to put images in or animations or something else. So anyway, there's some of the metadata about the show. But again, thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. You know, like it if you like it. And we'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourself and somebody else. Over now.